that we will continue in this hour, topic that we're talking about in hour number one, and that's financial planning. And we've been doing the show way more than 20 years every month to give people who are listening a chance to ask questions like the people who called in the first hour. So if you're thinking about what you're going to do with your money, you want to get a good return on your investment, you want it to be safe, you want it to reflect whatever your priorities are, you give us a call and we'll do our best to help. Our guests are Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And also here in the studio with us is John Masetich. He's president and owner of Kensington Financial. It's a professional money management firm. He is also adjunct professor of finance in the College of Business. And we're here for another hour and would be happy to answer questions. Again, all you need to do is dial the number, same one as always for the show. You'll come right here to this program. Contribution is not required. It's 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One thing that I want to maybe pick up on is the place where we were at the end of the last hour. I know that there are a lot of folks who are concerned about the safety of their money, and a lot of people have just taken their money and jammed it into the bank, which is, you know, good. Savings rates suddenly jumped way up. But the problem is that, you know, in exchange for that kind of security, the returns are terrible. And, you know, for people who are saying, well, I want to put my money someplace where it'll be safe and I get a reasonable return, they're looking at CD rates and they're just awful. You know, what sort of alternatives are there for people who want safety, security? You know, what's the best you can hope for in terms of what kind of return you can get?
Well, in any time, much less at extremes like we're in, at any time there's a relationship risk has to return. So, you know, the higher the one, the higher the other. It just so happens that when we get into silly times like this, for much of the reason that you just mentioned, when huge flows of money go from one place to another, I mean, it's like pouring water between two cups. One gets very heavy, the other gets very light. So when you think about rates of return in, quote, safe money, whether it's a bank deposit insured or a treasury security itself, I mean, literally, I'm looking at a one-month yield on a treasury bill of 2 basis points. That's 0.02%. I don't care, you know, what measured level of inflation you want to talk about. That's a negative real rate of return. You're losing money in that. And then the question comes, well, why is that yield so low? And you've already answered the question. So much money has run away from risk into things that are perceived to have no risk that the rates of return now just stink. It's the time that reinforces why you have a diversified portfolio. It's the time that reinforces why having all of your money sitting in ultra safe, I won't accept any more risk type of posture anymore, is a costly thing to do. Rates of return are all about, you know, cost benefit. That's really what we're seeing. And there are economic costs. There are psychological costs. If we have a benefit that we're buying called the safety and security, I can sleep well at night, then expect to pay the economic cost of a low rate of return. When we get into an exacerbated period of fear, like we're still in, then expect that cost to be even higher, namely lower rates of return.
Yeah. You talked just in the last hour and before, and when we talked, for people who want to put their money into CDs, your suggestion is to do the latter. Mm-hmm. Take it and divide it up, you know, however much you have, divide it in fourths or fifths or whatever, and you can get a CD, you know, go 9 months, a year, 2 years, you know, whatever, and divide it up. So that way you're making the best sort of compromise between locking your money up over a long term, and then they will continue to turn over. How far out do you feel okay going with a CD?
Yeah, there's again, the way to begin to answer that question is to say, what's the objective of the money that I have in the structure? If this is a component of a fixed income element in my total portfolio, and it's really going to be a core part of the process, you know, 4 or 5 year CDs are no problem at all. If you're rolling that type of 4 or 5 year ladder as a core component of fixed income, first of all, your money wouldn't be earning 2 basis points in its entirety right now, because you'd still be living on some yields from as little as a year, year and a half ago that are considerably higher. So you wouldn't be paying the big cost up front right now. If you're setting up that strategy from the get-go today, you'd probably want to draw that back and say, well, I'm not going to stretch it out 5 years because I think this is an extraneous period. Maybe I'd go out 2 years. And there's an exercise that anybody can do with simple math to basically answer this question. How much do I think interest rates are going to have to go up in order for me to lose by not doing this? And it's simple. If we just say, let's take the difference between a 1 year and a 2 year CD right now, just for stark comparison. If I put money in a 1 year CD and was lucky to get a half of 1%, and I put it in a 2 year CD and was lucky to get 0.75%, the question is this: how much money do I have at the end of 2 years by doing either one of those? And your mind kind of goes, wait a minute, Kevin, you're trying to trick me, because the 1 year CD 1 year from now doesn't give me that answer. What will be there in 2 years? And that's the aha moment. What I'm trying to get you to do is to say, how much money is there in a known 2 year CD 2 years from now? And then we can calculate that pretty easily. And then with the 1 year CD, the known amount there 1 year from now will have to grow at some rate of return for the next year in order to equal the sum that will be there at the end of the 2 year CD, right? So all I'm going to do is back into what that rate of return has to be on a 1 year CD 1 year from today in order for me to end up with more money by buying a 1 year CD and rolling it 1 year from today, as compared to buying a 2 year CD today. Mm-hmm. We call those implied forward rates. It's just a simple mathematical way for a person to say, effectively, what am I going to have to earn in the future in order to make up for what known amount I will have if I choose this alternative path? Okay. So it's an easy exercise. Doing that today with as low as rates are reinforces that a person setting up a ladder initially from the beginning, fresh money to invest, would probably not be going out in a 4 year, 5 year type of end point. They'd be looking at perhaps as short as 18 months, 2 years at most.
Okay. Anything, John, you want to add?
Yeah, I would agree with that totally. I wouldn't go out any more than 18 to 24 months. Kevin and I have talked about this extensively, and I think we're both in agreement that a few years from now, we're going to have higher interest rates because we're probably going to have higher inflation. And the reason is that, you know, the government is about to run this unprecedented federal deficit. The administration is estimating a deficit of 12.5% of GDP. The last time this happened, it was World War II. Maybe the Korean War, but I think not. I think the highest was during World War II, 12.5%. And frankly, the 12.5% projection is, how shall I say this? It's probably not realistic. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, is saying, no, you know, probably more like 13 to 15%. And to put these deficits in perspective, the worst year under Ronald Reagan was 6% of GDP. So we're about to double Reagan's worst year. And in the Eurozone, the worst offender is Italy, as usual. I love the Italians, but that's just the state of their economy. They are being criticized for a deficit of 3.7% of GDP, and Germany is also about 3.7%. And here we're going to run one at 12.5%, but it's probably going to end up at 15% of GDP. You know, whether you're a Keynesian advocate or a monetarist advocate a la Milton Friedman, I think both camps are in agreement that probably higher inflation and therefore higher interest rates are ahead. So I agree with Kevin. I don't think you want to go out more than 12 to 18, 24 months at the most. And I'll tell you what I'm doing personally and also for client money. I've been buying high-quality corporate bonds 12 to 18 months out, put some names on this. I've been buying Wells Fargo Bank, Goldman Sachs, Daimler-Benz. The yields are 3 to 4%. They used to be 7, 8, 9% during the crisis, you know, of last fall. They've come down to 3 or 4. But my bet, my implicit bet, is that Goldman Sachs will not default in 12 months. Wells Fargo Bank will not default in 18 months. So that's one alternative. And my bond guru is a Bill Gross, who manages the PIMCO group of mutual funds in the West in Newport Beach, California. That's his strategy right now, too. High-quality corporate bonds, definitely short-term. We're not buying anything 4 to 5 years out, certainly nothing 10 years out. Just too
okay.
risky.
So generally, I hear you saying about 2 years.
Yeah.
Don't go more out than that. Let me just real quickly give our phone numbers again here, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is our regular monthly show on personal finance. We've just extended it. We added on another hour. We thought this would certainly be a time where there'd be plenty of people who have plenty of questions. So if we can help you out, or you're just not really quite sure what you should be doing with your money, you can hear what Kevin and John have to say and put that in your big basket of advice that you're considering when you're trying to make decisions about your money. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. What I did, I guess I'm just curious, too, about where you think we are now in terms of the economy and what direction things are going to be going. Won't be too long here before we're at the middle of the year. And I think a lot of people were saying, well, you know, last year we were saying, let's see where we are at the beginning of this year. And then the beginning of the year we're saying, well, let's see where we are about July. I don't know, maybe in July we'll be saying, let's see how we are at about December. What do you think? Are we around at the bottom and we've maybe started even to climb up a little bit the other side of the valley?
I'll start. John is going to have some alternative thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
He and I have talked about this with each other quite a bit. I don't want to say that I'm more pessimistic than John, but I see this as a longer, drawn-out process maybe. And he'll correct me if that's a mischaracterization of our discussions. I think that what we're going through right now is something that is really quite legitimately, quite possibly, and hopefully a once-in-a-lifetime event. And it didn't take a year, 2 years, 5 or even 10 years getting to where we're at. This is a buildup of what's been going on for 40, 45, even 50 years. And, you know, you just don't take that to a crescendo and then undo it in a month or two or even a year or two. So I can see the future. I can feel a most plausible outlook for the future of one where our economy is going to go into a period where there will be a fits and starts. So are we falling into a depression? No, I don't think so. Has the bottom been reached in our happy days soon to be here again? I don't think so. I can see teasings, you know, whether the stock market rises 20% from its low in March or 30%. To me, that's a teasing, because I don't see the fundamentals returning to a solid footing in our economy, and I don't see those returning in any near term. Maybe over the next 4 to 5 years, we'll have this figured out. So be prepared to be teased, and don't make bets when you're being teased.
Okay. Well, John, what do you think?
Yeah, actually, I'm not in disagreement with any of that. I think I'm only just slightly more optimistic than Kevin. I do agree that going forward, we're probably looking – my best guess is that we're probably looking at a single-digit return in the stock market over the next 3 to 5 years, because the deficits really concern me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm really concerned about this. And also, you know, let's just look at basic facts. Since this crisis started in October of 2007, we've had actually 5 crashes. We're all familiar with the stock market crash, but what started this whole thing was the real estate crash. And at the same time, we've had a crash in commodity prices. Commodity prices are actually down 60% since this whole thing started, since this downturn started in October of 2007. We've had a 40% downturn in the stock market. We've had a 50% downturn in the international stock markets worldwide, 60% downturn in commodities overall. Of course, real estate has crashed. Most major metropolitan areas are down anywhere between 20 and 50% from their peak prices of 3 years ago. And we really had a crash in the money market fund. If it wasn't for the Federal Reserve coming in and backstopping, i.e. guaranteeing money market funds, money market fund balances as of last September, we would have had more than one money market fund that actually defaulted, that broke the buck. The reserve fund was the first money market fund, I think, sold on a retail basis to break the buck. I think those investors are probably going to lose 5 or 6%. There probably would have been tens and tens of more money market funds that would have broken the buck for the first time in history had it not been for the Federal Reserve, you know, bailing everybody out. So, yeah, I agree with Kevin to the extent that this is going to be a long, drawn-out process. I definitely don't think we're going to return to the good old days of 10, 15% a year in the stock market. And this has been actually the Warren Buffett message for several years, actually. He was saying this 10 years ago at the height of the dot-com boom. He was saying in 1998, 1999, look out below. And he was taking defensive action, and people were saying, oh, Warren, you know, old Warren has finally lost it. You know, he's 70-some years old. What does he know anymore? But, boy, he sure turned out to be right about that crash. He turned out to be right about this latest crash. And he was saying 10 years ago, we're in for a single-digit annual return in the stock market. He turned out to be overly optimistic because over the last 10 years, if you look at the Vanguard 500 fund as a proxy for the stock market, guess what? We're down, I think, something like minus 3% per year over the last 10 years. Kevin, can you remember another 10-year period like this?
No.
1930s, maybe?
Well, we got a couple of callers here we want to get to, and we're going to do that in just a moment. So I hope that they wouldn't mind just waiting up like a minute or two real quick while we again remind people who are listening also how important it is to support the radio station. We're here. This is our spring fundraising effort. We try to do this a couple of times a year, and we try to keep it as short as we possibly can. We actually used to be longer. And we've said, and we don't like that. Listeners don't like that. Okay. So we said, we're going to make this as short as we possibly can. But it's something that we really need to do. We have folks who have loyally supported us year after year, but we've always got to bring in new folks. And sitting here in front of the microphones and asking is the best way to do it. So if you're not a supporter of WILL, and I mean a financial supporter, why don't you give us a call and make a pledge, or you can go online. 244-9455 is the number. So if you'd like to do it that way, that's sort of the old-fashioned way. But you can also go to willpledge.org, and you can make a contribution that way. Either way, it's really important that it will help us meet our goal of keeping station strong. Martha Deal, one of the producers of Focus 580, has here stepped into the studio to see if we can convince a few people to be supporters of WILO.
You know, John just asked Kevin, do you remember the 1930s? And Kevin said, no.
Well, I'm sure he was asking if Kevin actually personally remembered the 1930s.
But you know, there is somebody on this campus, and I'll bet we've had him on air, who does remember the 1930s, or somebody who studies the 1930s, who can bring you the perspective from that time based on research and documents. And we have these gentlemen here this morning to give you the perspective from this time and 10 years ago, and they can bring you sides of the story that you don't get anyplace else. And we believe that our community is a better place for being able to bring you that kind of information, and that all people have equal access to that information and the opportunity to, you know, get more clarified, get understanding.
Sure.
So Focus 580 connects you with decision makers and opinion shapers. And we believe that the $200,000 we invest to keep you connected is money well spent. It is a sound investment with a sound return. And no, David, I'm not going into marketing. If you also believe this, please pick up the phone and call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org. And click on Support WILL.
Right. Well, we hope that people will do that. We're here today raising money. We'll be spending some time doing that over the weekend, and then we'll also be here again on Monday. And then I think at the end of the day, Monday, we're done. You know, we want to get back to our regular programming. We don't like to interrupt, but every once in a while, we just have to do it, particularly to remind people who are not supporters that we need you to. The dollar amount, maybe not quite so important. That's up to you. What we want to do is add you to our people goal of the number of supporters and make that number just as big as we possibly can. So one more time, 244-9455. That's the number to call. Or go to our website, willpledge.org. Our guest this morning on Focus 580, Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in College of Business in the Department of Finance here at the U of I, John Masetich. He's president and owner of Kensington Financial. That's a professional money management firm. He is also adjunct professor of finance in the College of Business. This is our regular monthly show on personal finance. We just added another hour on, and we'd like to see if we can help folks out. So we have a couple of folks ready to go here, both of them in Mattoon. So we'll take the one who came in first, and that's on line four, the toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I recently someone recommended the Harbor Bond Fund to me for governments and preferreds and corporates, and I wondered if you had an opinion on it, and I'd like to hear it if you do. And I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
Yes, John was nodding his head, yes?
I definitely have an opinion on that fund. I personally own it, and I have a number of clients in it. It's a very good, well-diversified, relatively low-risk bond fund managed by my bond guru, whom I mentioned before, Bill Gross, Newport Beach, California. He primarily manages the PIMCO group of mutual funds, but he also manages the Harbor Bond Fund. Bill Gross is not perfect. Nobody is. Nobody can predict, you know, what the bond market's going to do, the stock market, but he's got a pretty good record. I like it. It's good. He buys high-quality corporate bonds. He buys Ginnie Mae's. He buys treasuries. It's a very good fund. It's no load. You can buy directly with Harbor Bond Fund. I think the minimum investment is just $3,000. But you might also want, a caller, you might also want to just think about buying some individual bonds as well. There's one inherent disadvantage with all bond funds is that there is no maturity on a bond fund. Unlike an individual bond where you actually get to the maturity and you get paid your $1,000 back plus accrued interest, bond open-ended bond mutual funds don't work that way. There is no maturity. So if interest rates go up over the next few years, as Kevin and I think, then you know, Bill Gross is no financial magician. He will not be able to counteract rising interest rates. The price of the Harbor Bond Fund could fall, and that price decline could wipe out the interest you will earn. It all depends on how much interest rates go up. So I think it's a good long-term hold, but you might want to definitely, you know, supplement holding that fund with, you know, as Kevin talked about, a laddered portfolio of CDs and maybe some short-term corporate bonds as well.
Okay.
John raises a very good point. Again, it kind of harkens back to a little bit of how involved a person wants to be in their own management. A bond fund is going to lose value because it's a portfolio of bonds as interest rates rise. Individual bonds will as well. But if you own one or two individual bonds that do have maturity dates 18 months, 24 months from now, you know you'll get your money back in 18 or 24 months. The bond mutual fund manager is continually rolling those maturities into new bonds. And again, the fact that the fund itself doesn't have a maturity date means that the net asset value, the price we see it trade at, if you want to use those words, goes down when interest rates go up. That's a small price to pay for being a passive investor, and one way to mitigate that without being an active investor and literally buying individual bonds is to think about staging into your investment in that or any other fund. So, you know, you could, again, carve the money into a certain number of pieces and just write on your calendar every 3 months you're going to put that amount of money in the fund so that over the course of the next 2-3 years you've scaled into it. You've not timed purchases. You're not trying to time the market. You're only letting the volatility of market prices hopefully work in your favor. It's a little bit like the 401k approach, the 403b approach, the notion of taking money out of each pay period, putting it into a volatile asset class, and letting dollar cost averaging work for your favor. So just an alternative to a one-time purchase.
All right. On again to the next caller. This is also someone in Mattoon, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a question. I don't know if you talked about this earlier. I had to get away from the radio.
Okay.
How do you feel about using TIPS, either through buying straight through the government or through a mutual fund, and how would you use those if they're a good thing at this point in time?
TIPS?
Yes.
The Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. I like TIPS. I know the yield on them right now. I mean, well, the yield's been criticized from time to time. I don't think a person buys TIPS for a trade. So let me get real quickly to your answer, and then I'll back up for a definition. I like TIPS. I think they should be a more significant component in a fixed income portion of a total portfolio, specifically for the fears that I have with all of the federal spending that's going on. I'm not going to predict that inflation will rise to ugly levels that we saw back in the late 1970s, but I think inflation's going to go higher, and TIPS reward the rate of return if that happens.
And would you buy them any preference individually?
Yeah,
or through a fund?
My personal preference is the Treasury through the Treasury Direct program makes it very easy and cost efficient. You can set up a Treasury Direct account. Basically, the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia runs the accounting, runs the books for you, and you've got an account directly with them. It's safe, it's secure, it's super cost efficient. Again, if you want help in doing it, going through many of the Charles Schwab type of facilitators will do it for a nominal fee.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would buy the individual TIPS as well instead of a TIP mutual fund. Because, again, if you buy a TIP mutual fund, you know, there is no maturity by definition. So just buy them directly with the Fed, as Kevin was saying.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right. Next caller is someone on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if this is covering old ground. Sounds like you might have been touching on this in the call before the last, but problem I've had investing outside of a 401k is that taking money and putting in individual stocks is risky, but to get into a mutual fund, let's say you've only got around $3,000, that's typically the limit. You have to go in all at once, and then you've got, like, nothing else. And it sounded like you might have been giving away around that, or maybe not. I'm not sure. And do you have any tips for getting around that idea? There's no way to jump in to do it without jumping in if your savings is small enough.
Yeah, that's a good point, because many mutual funds do have a minimum initial investment. That's a sad thing, and I'm going to defer to John with his experience with mutual funds, much greater than my own experience with funds, as to what he might have for alternatives that do have some smaller minimums. But you raise a very good point. For a person that has the ability to make an initial investment and then, how should we say, you've got more. Let's say we're talking about a person that does have $15,000, $20,000 to invest. You can stage it in by doing the initial to get the account started and then doing routine $200, $300, $500 amounts. For a person like you or I who wants to set it up initially today, my total sum of $3,000 will only make that first stab. That's a sad fact of affairs. We can try to find funds that are still cost efficient, that don't have as high a minimum initial investments. And outside of that, I would have to remind you that making money begins with step one, which is saving money. So that $3,000 that might open the door for any mutual fund that you feel is suitable should only be considered the first step.
Well, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. My goal would be that every month I save money, and even if it's only another $50 or $100, they'll probably take it on a subsequent investment that way, and there's the power over time, okay?
That I believe. It's just that with the market this volatile, it's kind of a scary jump.
I understand, and if we had a little bit more money, then we'd just be spreading out that, how should we say, one-time lump sum to get the account open over a larger number of dollars. The math is going to work out very similarly, believe me. If you just say, well, okay, fine, I'll bite the bullet on the $3,000 minimum, I'll get in now, But the bigger goal is it's 50, it's 100 bucks every month that they're going to continue from this point forward and hopefully I'm able to ratchet that higher that's going to be going into those funds.
Okay, but kind of a follow-up related question. I like the idea of being able to, you know, go in small after the initial 3,000, but that limits you in another way in that inside of a 401k, you can pick like, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 funds to be in, and then you're kind of only in one if you keep doing the 50. So do you have a preference between maybe, you know, another 18 months later, you could come in to another fund and just jump in all at once, or should you really just stick with that one fund and keep feeding in? And I can see it both ways, I guess.
Well, again, I'll defer to John for specific funds to do this with, but if I were looking at a one-fund approach, then I would obviously be looking at some well-respected, comfortable, balanced type of fund to do that with,
sure,
as opposed to a very focused, narrow sector type of stock fund. So, you know, again, there's 16 ways to slice the apple. I'll defer to John for some fund ideas.
Yeah, I'll just say, caller, that check out a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA account where often the fund family will reduce the $3,000 minimum down to $1,000 minimum.
Well, actually, the point is to do something with savings outside of the IRA because
okay.
I've got the, you know, the IRA, I mean the 401k already,
mm-hmm.
and it's nice to have some savings for the long term that is not earning no interest, or when the stock market looks good, buying individual stocks and then getting burned. And you don't just get burned a little when you do that. You get burned a lot. So I'm trying to find a way to do better than a savings account is kind of the idea outside of money that I can never touch.
Well, you might consider calling Charles Schwab.
Okay.
And ask them, they should be able to bring up a list of funds where there's maybe only $1,000 minimum. I know there are a number of ones out there. None of them come to mind right now. I'm just drawing
that's
a blank.
A good solution.
But I think if you called Schwab or Vanguard, I think they could probably give you a list of $1,000 minimum funds. There should be plenty to choose from.
Okay, good.
All right. Well, thank you. And then maybe you find a fund that's got $1,000 minimum. So that's what you got to do just to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Then though that they don't. Is there any requirement that you put in a particular amount of money? Then as you get more money, or can you just however much money you've got?
Well,
then you can put it in.
It varies from fund to fund, but most of them have some small monthly minimum amount mm-hmm. that they'll encourage you to put in. But those amounts, generally speaking, are rather small, $50.
So it could be $100, $200.
That's right.
Yeah, you can.
If that's what you had.
I have a couple of funds set up that every month take money directly from my savings account. And I know that they still take at a minimum per month of $50.
Yeah, I think there are plenty of funds out there like that, $50 to $100 subsequent investments.
All right. I hope that helps. We'll go to Belgium next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I know Mr. Sinnoh and you folks always preach diversity, diversity, diversity. But occasionally, stocks do come along that offer a situation that just cries out for investment. And in this situation, I'm talking about GE. We've got an infrastructure that's falling apart. We've used up all these jet motors in this war. These people are involved in all kinds of stuff, and right now their prices are selling for less than a light bulb they manufacture. It's amazing value, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I don't disagree at all. And, you know, now that I've got a stock junkie on the call-in, I can confess I like buying individual companies. I have a couple of mutual funds I've just confessed, but, you know, that's my desire, my joy. It's, I guess, part of my genetic makeup. I like individual stocks. That said, the reason I still say for most people is that I believe most people are passive investors, not active investors. So the reason you hear John or I or anybody else in this type of setting suggesting diversification is because the people that we're making that suggestion to are the majority of the people that are probably going to be passive investors. So, now on to GE. You like it, don't you?
I've been with it for a long time. It was given to me a long, long time ago.
And
it goes up and down, and you have all kinds of problems with it. But right now, it's way, way, way down.
Okay, I understand that. I see it at $12.38 right now. I know it's been a single-digit stock when the market was setting lows back in March.
But $6,
right.
Which is really a good price.
Right. Well, that good is a relative term. So. And sometimes most of our problems are relative. But think about this for a moment before you get too carried away here and go out and borrow money to buy it.
No.
Okay. Right now that stock shows $1.24 annualized dividend, of course paid quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 10.5% yield at this current price of $12.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about risk and return. And we've said higher risk, higher return. When I look at the dividend yield on that stock right now, one of two things is screaming at me, and I don't know which is true. Either the stock is way too low, or it's way too high.
It's probably way too low.
Well, that could be.
Because historically, it's always ran at about 15, 16.
Oh, well, I understand that, but the dividend yield of 10.5% is way too high.
Yeah, the risk is that the dividend will be cut by GE. And I think they did have a cut in the last 12 months, and there could be further cuts ahead because of cash flow needs.
And that's why I want to bring the listener back to when that stock fell down to $6, it was just before they cut the dividend. What was it, the first time in 54 years that they cut it? And let me also remind you that General Electric makes more than turbojets.
They make all kinds of stuff.
Well, they make about 50% of their profits from banking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, GE Capital, their subsidiary.
Yeah, GE Cap accounts for over 50% of that company's profits right now. Now, I'm not bashing GE. We're just doing a little point-counterpoint here.
But the thing I'd like to point out also is I'm looking, like I said in the very beginning, I've had this for a long time, and that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I understand that.
Long-time investment.
And that's why I'm not going to diss GE. It's a great company. It'll be around 100 years from now. And your position in it is, I suppose, a wonderful thing. But I caution a listener in this conversation saying, gee, I should go out and buy GE stock.
No, don't borrow.
Well, I would just say, We need to look at what it is. For you, it's a wonderful thing, but that's based on history.
Yes.
Okay? If I'd have bought half of Marin County, California in 1954...
Yeah.
Okay? When the ground out there was still, scrub ground, and I probably could have bought it for $300 an acre,
mm-hmm.
It would have treated me pretty well, too.
Yes.
Now, if I bought that 3 years ago, I'm broke. Okay, so there are three important things with investing in the context of the discussion we're having. The three important things are timing, timing, and timing. You have the luxury of that long ago holding period. And I didn't buy Marin County in 1950.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, so the takeaway lesson, I guess, there's nothing wrong with buying individual stocks, particularly if it's a solid company with a good track record, been around for a long time, and you think that company has a future. But I'm sure you also would say, but it doesn't matter how good a company is or how much you believe in the future of that company. No one should take all of their investment dollar and put it in one company.
That's right, and I'll bring up Warren Buffett again as an example. He runs this conglomerate called Berkshire Hathaway. The A shares trade for about $92,000 a share, but the B shares, you can buy Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway for about, I think, what, Kevin, $2,950 or something. I personally own a few shares of that, the baby Berkshire. Yeah, Warren Buffett, though, as great as he is, you know, arguably the world's greatest investor, well, he lost about 15% last year, and he's down a few percent this year, I believe. So even the great one himself has lost money, and he runs a very diversified portfolio on top of it. Even with a diversified portfolio and being the world's greatest investor, arguably, he still lost money.
Yeah. We're coming down here to about, maybe we got about 5-6 minutes left. Someone wants to call real quick. Get in here so we can get you before we're out of time. Our guests are John Masetich and Kevin Wasby. John is adjunct professor in the finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. He's also president owner of Kensington Financial. Kevin is a lecturer in finance, also at the College of Business, and somebody who, going back a long way, worked for some of the financial institutions here in our area. So he's been a teacher. He's been in the business. And every once in a while, both of these guys have been here. Most of the time, the guy who's here is Dave Sinnoh. But we're glad to have Kevin and John here to try and answer questions and, you know, give people some advice, something to think about as they're thinking about what to do with their investment money. And, yes, let's see. Right at the beginning of the program, we talked about Smart Money Week, Illinois. We could do that again. It's a lot of events taking place in our area. This is co-sponsored by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and a lot of local institutions, banks, financial institutions, the University of Illinois. And there will be a lot of things going on, programs, seminars, informational meetings, and they'll be going on over the next week or so. And the idea is, you know, information resources for people who have the very kinds of questions that we get all the time when we do this show.
Right. I think, again, just the callers that have been calling in, it's great to be able – I mean, it's a heck of an opportunity to be able to talk with people, discuss different ideas, think out loud, share thoughts, ask questions. The whole venue that's coming up under the Federal Reserve's Money Smart Week, which kicks off Monday at the Champaign Public Library for the breakfast, but all of the sessions – are aimed exactly at this, and it's whatever aspect of a financial decision a person is making. There are seminars, there are help sessions from all different entities. None of it is a commercial sales pitch. The Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago is coordinating all of this. Everyone who participates in it is told that they cannot sell product. What a great opportunity to talk to people in aspects of finance at every different level. There are programs aimed at helping middle-age people save for a house. There are programs aimed at children in grade school, how to save for their future. And, you know, all across the spectrum of age, needs, so on and so forth. Even things like smart shopping at the grocery stores. I mean, how to live better on less, put it that way. So, yeah, I mean, financial literacy is a thing that these times of markets cry out for. Yeah. We'd like to believe that we're able to protect ourselves from this happening again. And I think we're more able to keep these things from happening again if we're all a little smarter about the decisions we make with money.
Well, again, we got a couple of minutes left. If someone wants to call real quick, we can get him in. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Other than that, I don't know. Is there any sort of last kind of thought you'd like to leave with folks? We'll make sure we have a couple of minutes here. John?
Yeah, I suppose my closing thought would be to hearken back what I said before. Everyone should sit down, yellow pad or Excel spreadsheet, and just see what their asset allocation is. That's the beginning point, because academic studies are so strong in showing that that's the most important decision you can make. It's not market timing. It's not security selection in the long run. That as you extend the time horizon from 1 week to 1 year to 10 years, 20 years, that asset allocation or that investment policy you set for yourself is really overwhelmingly the determining factor. And the other thing that comes out of the our world, or the academic world, is the need to rebalance your portfolio every year or two. If you don't rebalance and stocks are going way up, then you get overloaded with stocks, and then the crash comes and you're in serious trouble. Anybody who's been rebalancing every year like clockwork the last 10 years has not been hurt very badly.
All right. We now do have a couple of people. We'll try to get them both, at least one. Champaign, both of them are in Champaign. We'll start with line one.
I'll make it quick.
Okay.
How does one purchase individual corporate bonds?
Any brokerage could do it. That includes, the full-service brokers that you might go to an office here in town, or an online broker. It's Bonds are different animals. I would advise a person to do a little reading and basically see, you know, how they work, what they are, so on and so forth. But it's basically an investment opportunity that any broker online or in person could facilitate.
Sounds perfect. Thanks so much.
All right. And line number two, and also in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about hanging on to something that's not doing well. If you have a retirement account and this one has lost about 25%, would you just keep hanging on to it or would you roll it into something else? I'm tempted to roll it into something else, but I don't know if...
Well, what's it invested in specifically?
It's invested in a retirement... it's a, I don't want to say Vanguard, but one of the funds like that through Raymond James.
Is it a stock fund, do you think?
I think so. It was supposed to be a low risk, but the other low risk one that's with Fidelity is doing very well. Well, not very well in these times. I mean, it's not losing anything.
Is this over 1 year?
Yeah.
That you've lost 25%? Well, it wasn't low risk if you lost 25% over 1 year. It's, in all probability, a stock fund, and it may be low risk compared to an index fund mimicking the S&P 500, but it's definitely not low risk if you lost 25% by definition.
No.
So I think you need to, you know, to first of all, you know, determine what that specific fund is, get the trading symbol, and then go to Morningstar.com, punch in the trading symbol, and you'll get a rating from Morningstar. A very objective, strictly mathematically based rating system based on the rate of return and the risk combined. And there's a star system they have. 5 stars is top-notch, 4 stars is above average, 3 stars is average. And just see how that fund compares with everybody else. It's a good first pass in evaluating what you have in terms of the return versus the risk.
Mm-hmm.
So get the trading symbol, go to Morningstar.com, punch it in, and that'll give you a pretty good summary of what you have. But I don't think you have a low-risk fund.
No, apparently not, even though that was what was asked for and what we thought it was supposed to be.
You need to have a discussion then with that financial planner or broker then.
Yeah.
Ask them some tough questions.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, there we'll have to finish up here with our thanks to our guests, Kevin Wasby and John Masetich, for being here for the program. We'll be back here again next month. Dave probably will be back here again. But this is something that we've done. We built this into the schedule, do it every month, always on a Friday, with someone here to give advice, share some benefit of his experience, try to help people out with their financial planning. We want you to think very carefully about what you do with your money. And I would always say, you know, don't just do something because one of these guys says to do it. Get as many opinions as you can. Do as much research as you can. Be careful. But, you know, we do these shows to be one piece of the, of that research strategy that you're going to do. We hope that it's been useful to folks over time. And certainly, I appreciate very much you guys for being here.
Thank you, David. Always nice coming in.
Thank you, David.
Certainly, you want to find out more about what's going on in connection with Money Smart Week Illinois. Go to their website. It's moneysmartweek.org. You can find out.
Again, locally, most of the banks, credit unions, even supermarkets have pamphlets on Money Smart Week out. I know the Chicago Fed has been very good about blanketing different areas. I saw a stack out at the main desk Will studio.
Yep.
It lists all of the activities in the coming week, who the contact people are for them, what kinds of basic things you might expect to see at these seminars or demonstrations or whatever you want to call them. And again, it's an effort made by all of the people involved with the financial decision that who want to become more savvy about that decision. So always good to learn.